What's happening, Hardscapers? This is episode 255 of the How to Hardscape podcast, where we talk about how you can start and grow your hardscaping business. And on today's episode, we have returning guest for a third time, Jim Houston. You could listen to his past two episodes last year. That was the five stages of growth, as well as a critical analysis of multiple overhead recovery system, which is also his book that I've read, and it is very, very good. And we've gone into depth last year, more or less, about knowing your number topics, everything from pricing methodologies and deconstructing them. This year seems to be the year of marketing as well as team building. And with Jim on the show, we have him talking about how to grow a high performance team with minimum supervision. And with this comes a lot of different rabbit holes that we could pursue. So Jim has to put up with a lot of my wide-ranging questions throughout this interview. And if you want to learn more about Jim, he is at jrhouston.biz, B-I-Z. That's jrhouston.biz. If you want to see more about his resources that he has, his webinars, seminars, workshops, books, audiobooks, and so much more. But before we get into today's episode, we want to thank our sponsor, Cycle CPA. If you're looking for bookkeeping, accounting, CFO services, reach out to Cycle CPA at cyclecpa.com. Let them know How to Hardscape sent you for money off your services there. If you're looking for a software that does not use the multiple overhead recovery system, check out the How to Hardscape headquarters software. That will help you budget, estimate from that budget to recover your overhead job costs, schedule, time track, employee management courses, and our app is just around the corner. And with that comes a new price increase for new users only. So lock in your pricing. Reach out to me at How to Hardscape on Instagram or check it out at members.howtohardscape.com. And without further ado, let's get into today's episode with Jim. Today, we're joined by Jim Houston. He is a consultant for contractors, speaker, author. We've had Jim on the show for two previous episodes, Five Stages of Growth and The Critical Analysis of Multiple Overhead Recovery System. Jim, thank you so much for returning for round three here.
Well, Mike, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And round three, we are getting into how to build a high performance team that requires minimum supervision. But before we get into this, Jim, what is it that keeps you getting up and helping contractors and to continue to do this and to put out and to speak and to do consultations? What is it in you that helps you and gives you this drive to continue to do this?
You know, good question, Mike. It gets down to the people. I mean, I have great clients. I got people I've been working with for 38 years, and that's what really drives me. I mean, to see them succeed, to help them succeed, I think is fantastic. The other thing is that the more I think about it, I'm sort of a coach by nature. I mean, that's sort of what I'm doing. And whether it's coaching an athletic team or coaching business entrepreneurs, it's sort of the same thing. Seeing people grow, grasp concepts, and seeing them improve their lives, you know, financially, and being more successful personally is such a thrill that I think that's what keeps me going.
I'm already going to take a quick right turn here and ask you, do you see there being a difference in between coaching and consulting? And when somebody reaches out to you, do you know, if you do believe that there's a difference, do you know kind of which direction to already help them, whether it is coaching or it's consulting or it's a mixture of both with the problems that they're having when they reach out to you?
You know, I think it's a combination of the two. I would say with coaching, it's more personal development of the individual. And whereas the consulting, you're looking at the individual in context of a business. And so with the business coaching, if you will, you combine the two, and you're just trying to take that individual and get them from where they are to where they maybe need to be in many respects.
Gotcha. Okay, we'll get back on track here and tackle the how to build a high performance team that requires minimum supervision. Two things that stand out to me, two keywords from this: high performance and minimum supervision. So for a jumping off point in this, Jim, what defines a high performance and what defines minimum supervision in this
Sure.
statement that we have?
You know, high performance means that you got a team out there that's, excited, and they're able to bring jobs in on budget. And to me, that's a good thing. And so I want them to minimally be able to bring jobs in on budget, whether it's a landscape maintenance account or whether it's a installer perform at a high level in order to meet those preset goals financially.
So bringing jobs in on budget is has to do with that high performance piece there. What do we do as a business owner to communicate to our employees as to what that budget is? Are you more like an open book, or where do you take that so that the employees know what it means to actually bring a job in on budget?
You know, the main thing they have control over is the labor portion of the job. And so I'm going to talk to the team mostly in terms of labor hours budgeted to action. And so that's the one thing they have control over. They don't have control over what the materials cost and all this sort of thing, but they do have control over how productive they are and how well they pay attention to the project and get it done on here as well. There's just a lot of subtle things that go into that. But again, that's the main thing I'm going to give them. I'm going to set measurable and timable goals for the crews on there. Measurable in that we have to get things done by a certain time. You have clear-cut projects, design specifications and so forth. So that's pretty clear. But then also we're going to get it done by a certain time. So measurable and timable.
Okay, so measuring these, I would see this as three different levels. You got the company level, company-wide level, the division, and then also the crew. You could even go a step below that and maybe even employee. But at what point, a crew measurable for a job, that's pretty easy. A division would be all these crews coming together. Do you actually measure and set goals at each of these levels between like employees, crews, division, and the company wide, and communicate that all around so that everybody's pushing in the same direction? Or do you focus more so in on that crew level to communicate what is measurable and what they need to hit?
Sure. We know that it really starts with the crew level, at the crew level. And if the crews aren't producing the high level of performance, I mean, everything else is going to crumble around it. But everybody in the different areas, for instance, the division manager should be managing his crews and setting goals for everybody. And then the cumulative goal is going to roll up into the whole division. And so, but it really starts with at the crew level. And basically setting clear goals for those crew leaders and then working with them on there. And the whole company needs to have clearly established goals for revenue and then also for labor and so forth. But it's mostly revenue goals and then labor hour goals for the division on that and the whole company, essentially.
How would you tie in another position, like a salesperson position, into meeting these goals as opposed to a crew meeting goals, which are fairly obvious labor, or even a designer? Like, how do you go about creating goals for them, which are less obvious in terms of labor hours for crew?
Right. For a salesperson, they're going to have a sales goal. And let's say they have to sell $500,000 or $1 million worth of work, to cover all their expenses and to really justify having them out in the field working and selling projects or at the maintenance accounts. So they're going to be pretty measurable, and we're going to base their pay, maybe a base salary and then a commission on that. And I'd like to have the base pay be maybe 50% of everything they're going to earn, and then but about 50% of what they're going to earn is going to be based on performance on there as well. So we can work at establishing goals for everyone in the business. For the most part, I mean, even office staff and so forth, we can have objectives and goals for them as well.
Now, you've already mentioned the commission base for the salesperson. What about incentives or bonus structures or anything like that for those in the crew that meet those goals, those labor hour goals for projects? Have you ever toyed around with what those bonus incentive structures look like, and whether or not they're per job or per quarter or per year, and so on and so forth there for that? And that's a huge topic that I'm sure we could
Sure.
unravel here.
Yeah, performance pay for performance, whatever, piece rate. This is probably one of the most popular topics that I talk with my clients about. Almost everybody is asking me about performance pay. And this is where there are different ways of doing that. It's an area where we all need to really sort of do some more research on. There are different people championing this. I talked to a guy this morning. He's back in North Carolina. He knows a buddy in Florida who tried doing piecework pay last year, and he lost his shirt on it and got in trouble with the feds. So it's an area where I think you're absolutely right. We want to tie performance pay into the equation here, and it takes on various forms.
Definitely. And have you seen a structure that has been somewhat repeatable in the businesses that you have been able to consult with, where maybe they do it monthly or they do it quarterly or they revisit it? My concern, my thought process on it is like, what if I do it by job? I give them a bonus, but then we have to revisit that job because they were incentivized to get that done faster. Maybe they cut corners. We have to revisit it. I've already given them their bonus, and so on and so forth there.
We know you're dealing with hardscape projects yourself, and this is where it's a little tricky. I mean, you just can't, bonus somebody based on a project because, like you said, there can be problems down the road with it. So with say an installation team, whether it's plants, hardscape, whatever it might be, I like to have usually set up some sort of a bonus structure based on the labor hours in the budget, for the job. And if they go under hours in one job, well, that's fantastic. But then what if they go over on the next job? So I like to make a cumulative, for maybe a quarter and, for a particular crew. That way it evens out. Now, let me give you a couple of examples of some simple ways that you can incentivize people. And what you're trying to do here, it's very interesting, is that you're trying to get the crew member to think in terms of a cost-benefit analysis. Okay. And what I mean is that they're saying, hey, listen, I'm selling my labor to the company. Okay. And so I want to get the most amount of return for my labor that I possibly can. Normally, people are thinking, okay, if I want more money, I need to work more hours. Well, we want to change that because we want to tie performance or pay to performance, meaning if I want to make more money, I need to think like an entrepreneur, become more efficient, and I need to generate more revenue with my labor hours that I'm selling to the company. So this is where it's a subtle transition in thinking as we make that change. But once people do, and not everybody gets it, there are some people that just don't get performance pay. They don't want to be paid based on performance. But the people that do, what we've seen in a lot of companies, we've seen a 20% improvement in performance and productivity for people who embrace it and implement it as well. Let me give you a couple of examples. And this is where I think we need to differentiate between bonuses and incentives. Bonuses are sort of a attaboy. It's a nice thing to do, based on, past performance. It's not necessarily designed to change behavior. Incentives are exactly what they sound like. They're designed to incentivize people to change performance. Let me give you a good example. 25, 30 years ago, a client of mine on the East Coast, irrigation contractor, he had a service technician who was really underperforming. He was basically producing maybe 4 or 5 billable hours per day, and basically just wasn't getting it done. So what the owner did, and I thought this was sort of brilliant, he went to the irrigation tech, and he said, "Bill, from now on, I'm going to pay you $25 an hour." Now remember, this is 25 years ago. $25 an hour was good pay 25 years ago. Today it's almost expected for flipping hamburgers or whatever it is. But anyway, he said, "Bill, I'm going to pay you $25 an hour for every billable hour you produce. I'm going to pay you $12 an hour for every non-billable hour you have." Well, guess what happened to his billable hours? They immediately doubled on that. I thought that was the method was brilliant in how simple it was, but then how effective it was. So an incentive is properly structured, is designed to change behavior. Now, let me give you another example. Years ago, I had a company up in Maine, and the owner was going through a divorce and whatever, and was mentally out of the business. I mean, he just wasn't, it wasn't, and this lasted for about a year and a half. I mean, people that go through some life-changing tragedy like that, it takes them a while to get over it. Fortunately, this company had four really good managers, four guys who really had the best of the for the company in mind. They stepped up, they ran the company, and the company that year had its best year ever. Okay, maybe a lesson in here for the owner on this one. He's mentally out of the picture, and they had their best year ever. So there's a lesson there to be learned. But the company was doing about $3 million in sales. Profit was 15% net profit, so $450,000. What the owner did, he said, these four guys said, "Listen, I'm going to give you 10% of the net profit. You're going to split it evenly, and there you go." So we took 10%, $45,000 of the profit, split it up evenly, about $11,000 for each of these four people. Okay. Now, here's my question. My question is, did that, it was a nice thing for him to do, but it did it change behavior? I think, and my answer is, I don't think it did. I think I knew these four men. They worked hard. They had the best interests of the company at heart. They were just going to work hard and do the best they could. Now, I think it was a great thing for the owner to do, but it wasn't designed to change behavior on there. And so we have to distinguish between, I'd say, bonuses are a reward for past performance, whereas an incentive is designed to change behavior going forward on here. And I think that's really critical to understand the concept.
That makes a lot of sense. You did mention in an example, an incentive increased productivity. At what point do we start to then price our future projects with that new production that we're getting from our employees? Or do we keep it at the past production and not factor in that new efficiency that's coming from our crew? If that makes sense, what I'm asking there, where
Sure,
we're
no
now
question.
efficiency more efficient today than we were yesterday, do we start pricing with the efficiency that we're at today, or do we keep it at what our production rates were from before?
And you can say the same for a piece of equipment. You might implement a piece of equipment which improves productivity 30 some percent. Now, do you bid the work with a new improvement, or do you keep the work the same as with the previous standard in there? This is where you have to listen to the marketplace. If you implement the new improved performance standard, it's going to probably lower your price because of fewer labor hours. I don't think I would do that unless I had to, unless the market demanded that I do that. Now, you might just have more margin on the project, but I would still probably go in and price it the same as I used to. Now, I'll give you an example. Years ago, I had a company, the tree company up in New England, and the owner of the company, young man, but his father died and got an inheritance. He went out and he bought a whole bunch of new equipment for his tree crews, new chipper, new bobcat with a big grapple on it, and things like that. And so, and he told me, he said, "Jim, we can perform almost twice the amount of work that we normally do. And if we put in the cost or the changes that we would take a job, they would price at maybe $5,000. We'd end up pricing it at $3,000 for the same job." Because it was that much more efficient. And my thing to him, I said, well, listen, I don't think we want to drop our prices. We really don't have to. Let's take advantage of that extra margin, that extra efficiency. So I think, to answer your question is that you really got to listen to the marketplace. And if you have to become more competitive, keep up with the competition, you have that option. But I wouldn't necessarily lower the prices unnecessarily.
We want to take a break from today's episode to thank our sponsor, Cycle CPA. Are you basing your business decisions solely on a gut feeling? If so, you may be leaving potential profits on the table. It's crucial to base these important decisions on your financials, whether you're planning to hire a new employee, add another crew, purchase equipment or vehicles, or take on more debt to support a new service line. At Cycle CPA, they not only handle bookkeeping and taxes, but they also provide guidance in advisory services tailored to the landscape and hardscape industry. Their team of specialized accountants ensures that when it comes to making the next key decision in your company, you'll have a financial partner in your corner. So visit them at cyclecpa.com, and for $200 off, mention the How to Hardscape podcast. Now back to our episode. I think we've pretty well defined high performance and talking about those incentive structures that we can implement, and we can revisit this, but we also want to touch on minimum supervision and what that means in a
Sure.
business as well. So, where do you want to start there talking about minimum supervision and what that means? Does that mean owners completely hands off and they just hope their employees just take the reins and do what that needs to be done?
Well, it doesn't mean no supervision. And what I mean here is that here's what I see happening with a lot of teams out there is that some owners, some coaches, if you will, who are creating an adult babysitting service. I mean, they got people out there who may have the title of crew leader or whatever, but they're operating two or three levels below that. And so you have to constantly remind them to, take the right tools to the job, not to forget stuff, to pick up paperwork, all this sort of stuff. And so basically, what again, you're creating an adult daycare essentially with your crews on here. On the other hand, you have people who basically are they're expected to have high performance, high standards. They're expected to get the job done right the first time. And it makes all the difference in the world. I ask people a lot of times in seminars and stuff like that, who in your company are the problem people in your company, the people you really don't enjoy working with? And they immediately know who to identify in their company. And the other thing is who are the people that really are fun to work with? They're ahead of you all the time. They're solving problems ahead of you. Whereas the first category, these people are the ones that are not just bringing problems to you to solve instead of them solving them. They're not just bringing problems to you. A lot of times they're creating problems on there. And this is where think about it again. Are you creating an adult daycare system, or are you building a high performance team, high expectations? You can see all this in the sports field with athletic teams all the time. And you see the high performance teams out there that really are operating in a very high level of efficiency, and they're really a lot of fun to work with on here as well.
From the very beginning, getting employees into our business, where do we start? Where we're identifying good employees that may eventually require minimum supervision in our business.
Yeah, I think it starts right in the recruiting process. And and this is where that I think, it really starts at day one. You're bringing people in, you're identifying what the expectations are, and you're consistently reinforcing those expectations on here. And so you start there from day one, or actually in the interview process, and then you keep building on it with clarity of goals, expectations down the road. And then coaching, paying attention to these people, and having an environment where people want to work, and there's opportunity to grow, and they realize that, hey, there's a future for me at this company.
This is really something that's been top of mind for me last year on our podcast was very much about knowing your numbers and numbers, and we've had you on the show to talk about. This year is really about the employee and building that business with these employees.
Right.
So you did mention coaching and training and showing them that there's an opportunity, a growth path forward in the business. Can we expand on those? Like, what does it look like to actually show an employee coming into the business that there's an opportunity? Or do you wait, hire them, wait, see that they could be molded into a good employee, and then show them the career path forward into the business? Or is it just blanket statement, show everybody the career path forward in the business and show them the steps to get there?
Yeah, I think you want to show them a clear path and just emphasize the fact that, listen, if you're creative, you're hardworking, you show up, get good values and stuff, and to contribute to the team, there's ample opportunity here for you to grow. And, you know, maybe you're going to start as a laborer. Next step is you're, you know, an advanced laborer, whatever, and then a crew leader, and then eventually maybe even a manager on here as well. So I want to lay out that process. You know, it may not be explicitly all the time initially, but it's like, hey, listen, here's a place where you can come, you can grow, and we're a team. And I think most people want to be part of a team, and a team that's, you know, doing something worthwhile on here, that pride as well. So I'm going to take that process. I'm going to start with somebody and say, okay, here's your job description, if you will. And it may be, hey, if you're just a laborer, it's like, okay, your job description is to show up on time, be properly, you know, uniformed, work hard, ask questions, and take initiative. It can be that simple. Whereas, you know, somebody else who's a crew leader or somebody that's, you know, looking to be hired for a position like that, well, there's a different skill set. So I'm going to identify that and, you know, have clear expectations all around.
And when it comes to coaching and training, is this something that you would always have somewhere, say like a bank of courses or a coach or a consultant that is easily accessible to every employee? Or would you cherry pick employees and be able to identify those employees and allow them and invest into them that training and that coaching? What does that look like for you in terms of coaching and training for employees?
You know, and I think we need to pay attention to the individual. I mean, think about it. In the States here, we've got, of course, football and the Kansas City Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes and so forth. But imagine yourself, if, let's say Patrick Mahomes shows up at training camp, you know, first day of the training camp, he's a rookie. And the coach looks at him and he says, you know, I think I'm going to put you in charge of the equipment locker. I think you'd be a great guy to, you know, take care of the equipment and all this. You'd go like, well, coach, maybe Patrick, you'd have a different position for him. And so don't you think maybe you want to see him, see if he can throw the football or this type of thing? A lot of times what is happening is that people aren't paying attention to their team on that and asking some questions about, you know, who is this kid or this person? What are their capabilities? What are their aspirations on there? And that is a big thing. You know, what are they trying to accomplish with their lives? I think in today's marketplace, young men and women, it's like there's so much confusion out there. They just want to get a grab a hold of it and do something with their life. And I think, you know, these are our work areas is a great way where we can influence people for the better. So I'm going to bring somebody in. I'm going to tell my manager and say, listen, keep an eye on these people. You know, see who the movers are, the people that want to grow. Let's give them opportunities and talk to them and coach them. But I want to pay attention to individuals. And, you know, in that way, we can coach them up. But we have to get to know them. We have to see, you know, what turns them on, what turns their crank. I had one company in Texas. I thought this was great. It was an irrigation company in Houston, Texas. And I went out into the on the garage area, you know, the space out there. And I noticed they had pictures of their key people on the wall. And underneath them, they had a big goal that person was trying to accomplish it with their life. One person was wanted to get a college degree. Other person wanted to buy a new truck or a new boat. So they had these people with all these with their one of their key pressing goals in their life, something they were trying to accomplish. And so, and the owner, by doing that, he was directly plugging into a real motivational part of that person. And he says, okay, now I can help them achieve that goal on there. And so this is where that I think that type of approach is extremely important on there, you know, just trying to get involved and identify people, where they want to go, what they want to do with their life. But some people don't care. If they want to do drugs all day, we're not going to have a place for them. But the ones who want to grow, you know, they're the ones we want to identify, and we want to help them get on down the road of life so they can become a better person, better to develop a better skill set, that type of thing.
And how do you go about identifying those people? Are there a certain list of characteristics, traits, attitudes, anything that can help us identify those people in our business that would be the best culture fit and performance in the business?
You know, a lot of my clients use a DISC test or some personality profile test, you know, to get a little bit more insight. This is mostly for the larger companies in many cases. But I think, you know, you just got to get out there and pay attention to people. You got to talk to them. You got to ask them, you know, what their life goals are, that type of thing, and become fairly explicit in that. And also pay attention to what they're doing at work. You know, get some. I was with a company the other day, I think down in Arkansas, and they had a young lady there. She's, I think, early 20s, and she was a team member on the landscape construction team. And, you know, but she had had a horrific family background on here. And so this company, they knew she had some baggage, if you will. And stuff like that, but they found a place for her where she could excel, she could be accepted by the other members of the team, and she could contribute. And you know, once they did that, I mean, she really blossomed in here. But this, a lot of these people that come into our offices, into our businesses, have a lot of baggage. And this is where, but if we pay attention to what their skill set is, what their goals are, and their daily performance. If you get somebody who's slacking off all the time, or whatever, well then, well, maybe you can't do much with them. You know, it's the old concept, you can't push a rope. In other words, you can't, there's three things in life that they say are impossible. So one is to climb a fence that's leaning towards you. The other is to kiss a girl that's leaning away from you. And the third is to make someone else successful. And so this is where you can just provide the opportunity. And if they, you know, respond to it, fantastic. I think a lot of people will. But this is the other thing is also, you know, just being a positive person who is encouraging people, and you know, just somebody who takes interest in where other people are and what where they want to go on that.
I'd assume that this takes constant communication or something that the business owner can point to and show their employees that this is what they're doing to create a career path and to create a career in this industry for their employees. Is there something that the business owner can do? Is there, you know, a list of things, whether it is a visual sort of representation of their career path through the business, or a mission statement or a vision that the company has for their employees? Is there something that can always be there that the business owner can point to and say, this is what we're doing, and this is what you can do in the business to get to and achieve your goals?
Sure. A lot of companies will, you know, post their core values. I think that can be important, and so forth. The other thing, I think you can actually have a career path where you make it very explicit, and you could, you know, just sort of, you know, whenever you get people together, you know, just reinforce this. But you can also have it in writing, as far as I think, you know, okay, you start out as a laborer. If you have clear job descriptions for the next level, say a lead man or a lead person, or then a crew leader, if you have clearly identified performance standards for that position, not just, and also the pay amount, this is where these people can see these and they say, okay, here's what the next couple steps are and where I can earn myself up the totem pole, if you will. And so I think that's really important. The other thing it does, and you know, and for owners especially and for managers, I don't know about you, but everybody I know could use more money. Okay, I mean, I can use more money. And so you get somebody coming into your office and hey, boss, I need more money. Well, don't we all? Okay. And so if you have these clear expectations, you say, okay, if you want to earn more money, let me show you a way to do it. You know, here's where you are right now with your skill set. Let's work on your skill set, get you to the next level, and you can earn more money. And so, I mean, everybody is constantly pursuing that, you know, the more money thing. And so I think what you want to respond with is, okay, let's tie pay remuneration to skill set. Get people thinking, okay, if I want to basically get up the ladder, this is what I got to do to improve my performance and improve my skill set. So I want to have that pretty clearly identified. And what is happening here is that we are beginning to develop clear pictures of what these different positions look like and the skill set that's required to perform them on here. So we want to get things more explicit in the organization, not just run by intuition on here as well.
Gotcha. Is there, I'm going to revisit a question that I have that came up in my head here. Before I get to that, I want to get into recruiting. Where have, in your experience, have you found companies that find a great way to recruit and have success time and time again recruiting this way? I'll start with that there.
You know, that's a real challenging area. I mean, recruiting, I find probably one of the best ways to recruit is to be a great company, a company where people are excited about where they're going, they're growing and so forth. That becomes sort of a magnet out in the marketplace. Years ago, I was working with an irrigation contractor in Detroit, and I told him, I said, Mark, you know, what happens once a company gets to a certain size, you know, instead of having to constantly go out and try to find people, people start finding you. He didn't believe that at first, but until he became a large $5-7 million company. And what happened was people would show up at his door because he had a great reputation. He had, you know, people would talk about it. He was well known in the community, had great integrity and so forth. And so people would show up. Not only would they show up, but they would stick. You know, they'd stay around. And turnover was pretty minimal. So I think one thing is, if you want to, you know, find people, be a great company, and that will attract good people to you. There's other things you can do, of course, job fairs. One thing is intern programs. I think that's popular. People are using I think things on the internet. Indeed seems to be pretty successful. It's where a lot of my clients find people. There's other, you know, sources out there like that as well. People will use recruiters. You know, I think recruiters can be okay, but I've seen a lot of failures with getting people through recruiters. I think recruiters are really good for some high key positions, controllers, maybe general manager, operations manager like that for a larger company. But boy, you got to just be hiring all the time, looking all the time for good people. A lot of times the people that will start working for you have no experience in the green industry. And so, okay, that should not be a deal stopper. But basically, I think you find good people, you find a place for them, put them to work and let them grow into a position, you know, that type of thing. So I think you got to be constantly recruiting, encouraging your existing employees to bring people in, you know, friends and neighbors, whatever, and say, hey, listen, if these people stick around, we're going to give you a bonus, you know, for bringing them in on here as well. So this is where I think people don't realize that if you want to attract the right people, you got to be a great company to begin with. And that is, I think, job number one. Think about it, you know, within sports. I mean, the great teams, you know, Alabama and college football, some of these other basketball teams and so forth, they have people coming to them because they have a great team. They got great performance. They get a great record. And so the first goal for a company in order to recruit effectively is to be a great team, be a great company.
At what point do we recruit for a position externally versus internally? For example, I have a foreman position open, and there is a laborer or lead hand position that thinks that they're ready for that foreman position, but I don't believe so. So I hire externally, I bring somebody in, and now I've maybe offended that person who may be a good foreman next year, but not this year. How do I resolve conflicts like this? And when do I look at internal versus external recruiting for those sure. types of positions?
You know, it's interesting. I think a great coach, a great leader is really interested in the long-term development of their people. And it was interesting. You see some leaders that, you know, you're around them and they're all about themselves. You know, they want to, you know, glorify themselves, and it's all about me, 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 and versus the team. Where you get the great leaders, they're all about people, developing people, and that resonates throughout the organization on there. People realize that, you know, this individual is really interested in my best interest. And I think if you are that type of person, you can, you know, take somebody aside and you say, listen, Joe, you know, I really wish, you know, you could take this position, but you're just not ready yet. I know you don't think you are. You think you are ready. But, you know, trust me, I need to give you another season to get to the point where you are going to be ready. At that point, I think, you know, we're both going to be happy about getting you into this new position. I just don't want to put this person in a position where they're going to fail, and that's going to be, you know, bad on everybody on here. And so this is where I'm going to, you know, talk to that person. But I'm assuming I've got a good relationship with that person to begin with on here. And so I think they say that, you know, rules without relationship lead to rebellion. And so if you're going to give somebody hard, bad news, okay, if you don't have a relationship with them, it's going to be bad news for everybody. But if you have a good relationship with them, they're going to trust you. They're going to say, okay, listen, you know, they may not like it, but they're going to work with you for another season. And then you got to follow through. I mean, you got to say, okay, here we are. We're another year down the road. You've made that improvement in your skill set. I think you're ready for that foreman's position on there. But it gets back to the relationship with the individual.
Let's talk about a kind of a starting hardscape company. Maybe they have one or two crews. And the business owners now kind of identified themselves as somebody who is a foreman or like a hands-on type of person, not so much a business owner. Is this something that they might look at maybe bringing in a partner that can take care of the business operations? Or is this looking at somebody who might just hire somebody to take care of the business operations and they stay in the field because that's what they love and enjoy? Or option three being they just pack it up and work for somebody else and get that hands-on there?
You know, you're asking a really good question. And, you know, this is where you find some people that they're just over their head. And there are a lot of people, for instance, when somebody wants to sell a business, you know, and I have people that are coming to me to say, listen, I got a business that's for sale. I'm thinking about buying it. What do you think? One of the first questions I ask is, why does the owner want to sell? A lot of times the person is at retirement age. They want to get out of it. Number two, it might be that, you know, they're just overwhelmed. You know, they just don't have the skill set at this point in their life to run a business and deal with all the complexity. They're more of, like I said, a nuts and bolts type of person. They're great at performing a task or as a crew leader or something like that. But when you throw in all the business stuff, the marketing, all the other things, it just gets them out of their wheelhouse. And so this is why in the book, The E-Myth, talks a lot about this. As far as, you know, not seeing yourself as a technician, but as an entrepreneur on here, totally different skill sets. So this is where that I think that type of owner, if you get in that type of situation, number one, you're not going to be very happy. Okay. And so you realize that things, this isn't what you thrive on. So, okay, so maybe you do go and work for somebody else. For most guys, to me, that would be a wise decision. I have seen a lot of owners being really stressed out, working 12, 14 hours a day, never seeing their families and so forth like that. I said, Joe, you'd make a lot more money if you go work for somebody. You're probably scraping by and making maybe $40,000 a year, but if you took your skill set and worked for somebody else, you'd be making $75,000 a year on here. The other thing is, your family life would greatly improve. And so, what's the smart thing to do here, Joe? And so, now the other thing is, you could think about getting a business partner. Okay, and so that's where I think that was not necessarily an easy solution, but it is a potential solution. More often than not, what I see in partnerships is that you have one partner is pulling the wagon, the other partner is sitting in the wagon enjoying the ride. And so this is where, I mean, it's not an easy solution to go out and find a business partner on there. So I think, those are a couple of options. The other thing is to try to improve your skill set as far as learning how to be a more well-balanced manager, entrepreneur that can handle these things. And even, hiring a business coach, somebody can sort of look over your shoulder and coach you. It's a tough issue. What I find interesting in the landscape industry, the green industry, is that roughly, I think about 12% of the contractors out there make it to $1 million in sales. About 2% make it to 5 million and above. And so I think probably 75% of the contractors out there are half a million or less in volume in sales. Now, the question is, can somebody move up the ladder to these different levels of complexity, but also different levels of revenue? And that was sort of what the five steps in an entrepreneur's life was about that we talked about in the previous session. And so this is where the guys that get stuck, and men and women both who get stuck at a certain level, it's all about how they think or how they don't think, really. Somebody who's really good at, working with widgets, whatever, not hates working with people, well, you better not try to build a team. To be a successful entrepreneur, a couple of things you have to do. I think four things you have to do. One is you have to be able to build teams. Number two, you have to be able to build systems. Number three, you have to be able to network like crazy. Number four, you need to understand the role of a CEO. And so you can see a lot of people I know that just, I just don't like networking. I don't like getting out and talking to people, blah, blah, blah. Well, you're going to have a tough time as an entrepreneur because you not only need to build an internal team, your crew leaders, your office manager, your division managers, that type of thing, but you also have to be able to build an external team. Your CPA, your attorney, your different associations and educators and insurance people. You have to build a team around you, external team, about maybe 20 professionals. So if you have an issue that comes up, you can go to them. The successful entrepreneurs I work with, they build those teams. They display those four characteristics on there. And so this is where for that person that just isn't enjoying, the experience of being a business owner, you want to sit back and analyze that, and you're thinking maybe I'm a square peg in a round hole, or vice versa. And the other thing is that, okay, what can I do about it on here? Maybe there's the association can help with some of these things. Maybe there's some consulting out there that I could, get some help with or whatever. But this is why it's a challenge, and you got to really pay attention to yourself and your intuitive benchmarks, meaning, are you really enjoying what you're doing and flourishing? That is critical. And when I say flourish, as an individual, our responsibility is to flourish in all areas of our life. Okay? Not the vocational aspect of it, the financial, the social, the physical, the mental, spiritual, all these things. We should be flourishing in all these areas. As an owner, a leader, our goal in life is to help other people flourish. When you're out there doing hardscape projects, what you're doing is you're helping your customers, your clients, to have a better life, a more enjoyable life, enjoy that, the outdoors and so forth. You're helping that person to a certain degree flourish in their environment, in their home setting. And so this is where we need to be thinking about that and to really understand that concept, so we can help that person who is, maybe in the wrong position at the wrong time, say, okay, how can they get to the next step where they can flourish?
Jim, how often would you suggest revisiting with employees and going over their goals, going over expectations, more so like on a one-on-one basis or a very small group setting, to get to know your employees better, but also for example, here in Toronto, our seasons are very short, so like 8 months max is what we've got, and that time can fly by. So how often would you
Sure.
recommend kind of meeting with your employees and going over those goals, expectations, and seeing that they're meeting the challenges that you've set for them and that they're getting to accomplish their goals?
That's a good question. I think when it comes to training, and in my job description book, I talk about this. I think what everybody in the company, including owners, office managers, everybody should have a quarterly training goal that is measurable and timable. In other words, for the crews in the field, that could be fairly simple. I want to improve my skill set in learning how to be a crew leader, to install, a patio walkway and so forth. But I want everybody to have at least one or two timable, measurable training goals in the organization, okay, quarterly. And so I would say that, things get so crazy throughout the year, and especially in smaller companies. And so, but now if I want to visit these things at least two or three times a year, sit down with somebody and say, hey, here's what the deal is. Here's what we need to think about. And make that a specific goal that you have with your staff. And so if you make it, and it could be after hours or whatever, and just say, Bill, hey, Mary, let's sit down for 5, 10 minutes and identify how you're coming along with this goal. I want to write these goals down for everybody, for you as an owner or division manager, and revisit them and just keep an eye on them because this is your team. And so I'm going to get in there and look at them that way. If I have a larger company, I want to have an HR department this is doing this. I want an HR person that is identifying training goals for everybody, and even the owner of the company should have some training goals and things on there that's going to stretch them and help them grow. And so if I have an HR department, this is a key thing for that person in charge of HR to do this on that. I want that HR person to be doing my onboarding, okay, doing the overseeing the training, doing the offboarding if necessary, that type of thing. And basically, corporate wellness, making sure that everybody in the company is thriving as much as reasonably possible within an organization on that.
Got it. Jim, I think we have just scratched the surface with this a little bit here, and we're coming to a close here. What I want to do here is just quickly summarize the list of things that I have here and then allow you time to fill in any blanks or correct
Sure.
me from what has kind of come up here, as well as anything that we kind of have not gone deep enough here as a summary for you too. So, building a high performance team that requires minimum supervision, high performance being something that is measurable, it's attainable, and we can quantify it and also use our intuition to see how our crew, our employees are doing, especially for our crews. This is labor hours that we can measure against, and we can also offer an incentive program, not a bonus program, a bonus program just being something not to do with their job specific incentive, and In doing so, also hiring and retaining, coaching and training employees to become not only high performance employees, but have minimum supervision in that incentive program, and that high performance kind of all plays into factor with that. And yeah, I think that's the majority of the notes that I got here. Anything that you'd want to add on top of that, as I kind of look at more notes that I also put on there, anything that you want to add on top of that, change, correct, or anything that you believe we missed out here on?
You know, I think this all gets back to leadership. And the key thing is for you or me as a leader is the basically the question is, how can I be the best leader I can possibly be? Okay. How do I get there? I think one thing to do is to study some of the great coaches that we see in the sports arenas, you know, or generals, some of these people. There are a lot of great books out there about leaders, and I think we really need to make it a point that we're going to become the best possible leader possible for our team on that. And so, like I said, there's a lot of resources to identify that. The other thing is to realize that your primary role as a leader, as an entrepreneur, is to help people flourish. Now, number one, you have to flourish as an individual. It means you've got to take care of yourself spiritually, intellectually, physically, you know, financially, and so forth. You want to basically, you know, flourish in that capacity on here. Then the next thing is your objective is to help other people in your organization, inside the organization, outside the organization, flourish. You know, your family, relatives, your business associates, team members, that type of thing, your clients. You want to help them flourish as well. In this process, I think there are, we use benchmarks and KPIs, key performance indicators. But there are two types of benchmarks and KPIs. There are the objective analytical ones that you can measure with a calculator. I'm pretty well known for that arena in the landscape industry, you know, benchmarking, financial analysis, budgets, all that sort of stuff. But the other component of benchmarks and KPIs are intuitive benchmarks and KPIs. And that's where you and think about this. The intuitive benchmarks are really more real than the ones you put in the calculator. For instance, the question is, you know, how much stress are you going through? You know, how much, you know, and it's like, what's your stress level? Are you really enjoying life, but are you stressed out most of the time? Okay, well, that's an intuitive thing to measure. You don't measure it with a calculator, but you know it, you know, personally, you know, exactly where you are. Another question being peace. How are you? Are you at peace with yourself and your life and where you're headed and all these sort of things? Again, you don't get a calculator out, my HP 12C calculator, to figure out how much peace you have. It's an internal intuitive thing. So we need to really pay attention to the external aspect of these benchmarks and KPIs, which is how we measure a lot of this performance. But effective leaders also pay attention to the internal, the intuitive benchmarks and KPIs. Those are absolutely critical to monitor. I mean, it's like, you know, yeah, you may end up being a multimillionaire, have a huge company, but if you're a miserable person, miserable to be around, who cares? You know. So this is where I think that's what I would add to wrap it up. It's a great topic. Appreciate your having me. And any other thoughts you can think of?
Last one here that just came up: intuition. How do we hone that as a business owner? Does that just come with experience and time, or is this something that you can actually kind of work on and practice to have that intuition to identify employees that are leaders in our business and we can help to promote them and so on and so forth?
Sure, that's a great question. In my book, Benchmarks for Landscape Construction Professionals, I have a whole chapter on intuitive benchmarks. Number one is to monitor these areas. You know, are you at peace? You know, what about your stress level in your life? What about anger? These types of things. You know, and so I have a number of categories, about 7 or 8 categories, where I want to just pay attention to intuitively and say, you know, how am I doing in these areas? And I mean, you might know people that have issues with hate or anger or whatever. Well, that's you're going to know that intuitively, but this is where we need to identify that and then take some sort of positive action to deal with it on here as well. But this is why I think this is the intuitive aspect of these benchmarks are some an area, an arena where we generally, especially as guys, don't want to talk about. But it's critical if we're going to be an effective leader and build a great company that requires build a great team that requires minimal supervision.
Jim, the more I talk to you, the more questions I have. And I appreciate you putting up with me going this way, that way, in whatever way with this conversation. And I would love to always have you back on for another episode here. But until next time, where can our audience go find out more about you? Where do you want to point them to? And yeah, where do you want to leave them with?
Sure thing. Our website, www.jrhouston.biz, and they spelled the city of Houston wrong. It's JRHUSTON dot BIZ. And so go there and you can see more about me. Email me at jhouston at jrhouston.biz or call me at 800-451-5588, and we'd love to talk to you.
Jim, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast episode. Once again, check out Jim at jrhouston.biz. That's jrhouston.biz to find out more about Jim, his resources that he has available there, and any other things that you'd want to reach out to him about on that contact page. Reviews, would love them. If you're on Apple, a 5-star rating and a written review would be very helpful. Spotify, quick couple of presses and you can give us a 5-star rating there as well. Those are always helpful. So if you found this information valuable or this podcast valuable, I'd really appreciate that. And if you're looking for bookkeeping, accounting, CFO services, reach out to Cycle CPA at cyclecpa.com. Let them know how to Hardscape sent you for money off their services there. And if you're looking for a software to dive into, the How to Hardscape headquarters could be for you. Check it out at members.howtohardscape.com or shoot me a message at howtohardscape on Instagram. We'll schedule in a demo and go from there. And we look forward to meeting with you next week on the How to Hardscape podcast.